Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, the world as we find it, the daunting challenges of natural disasters, challenges in persistent conflict zones, and the economic struggles on a smaller scale of a monthly calendar that is a slave to the familiar paycheck-to-paycheck existence for so many American families. Listen.
This is Kevin Sutton from Dallas, Texas. My weakest weeks are the two middle weeks of the month. I'm self-employed, and so I get most of my pay and income toward the last week of the month. And by the time I've paid the first of the month bills, the rent, the utilities, and so forth, it makes weeks two and three of the month the most lean.
All this hour, we'll hear more check-to-check stories of how your monthly calendar is impacted by the rhythms of benefit checks or paychecks. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Calendars, maps, advanced planning, design thinking, and exploration this hour of the best laid plans and how they can have an impact even when the challenges seem so overwhelming. We're trying to hang on to the positive this hour. In the Philippines, in the aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan, America, the former colonial master, will bear the responsibility after the Philippine government in the relief effort. We're going to be talking about that. We're about 5 days out now. The first wave of humanitarian aid has finally begun to reach the worst-hit Tacloban. The calendar of distribution is starting to take shape while the clock ticks on how much the society in the Philippines will tolerate delay. Joining me is Bob Kitchen, International Rescue Committee's Director of Emergencies. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So is the frequency of distribution beginning to increase, and how much time pressure is there based on some of the reports of unrest that we're already hearing?
Well, there's huge pressure, not just because of the unrest, but because of the urgency that people have lost their income, they've lost the food stocks, their agricultural land has been decimated. So the pressure is on to distribute aid. We're getting there. The aid is reaching the major hubs. It's just very difficult to access the areas that have been hardest hit because roads have been washed away, bridges have been knocked out. There's no power, there's no communications. It really is a challenging place to work.
How do you set a priority? Is it getting aid into the worst affected areas or getting people out to where aid can be more equitably and effectively distributed?
Well, what we're seeing so far is numbers are moving every day. But so far, the UN is stating that 670,000 people have been displaced. The interesting number is there is only 55% of those have come out and are congregating in displacement centers. So that's nearly half of the people are staying on their own land close to their own homes. They want to rebuild. They just need help to enable that work. So the priority for us is to push out into communities where there's people who just need help to restart their lives. One of our biggest priorities is to look at safe water, safe sanitation, the risk of public health outbreaks such as cholera. As the time ticks by, that gains momentum.
And, appealing to people who are likely to, look into their food pantry or possibly send blankets to the Philippines, give us a realistic sense of what's actually needed in terms of personnel, in terms of, trucks, actual clean water. What is most urgent right now?
Most urgent. We appreciate the generosity of the American people. Money is what's needed. Philippines is a developed country. We have air assets coming into the area to lift food, to lift water filtration systems into the area. We just need money, in part just to get people back to work, to rebuild and clear debris and put money in their pockets so they can afford to buy food, to restart the market. That's the biggest priority. We understand people want to help it. It's going to our website, rescue.org, donating money to other organizations as well. That's the best way people can help right now.
We're talking from Washington, D.C. with Bob Kitchen, International Rescue Committee's Director of Emergencies. You said something a moment ago that struck me, and that is that even though there are a number of displaced people, a small fraction of them are moving out of the most affected zone near Tacloban, and people are staying close to their homes and their land. Is that because they feel a certain level of insecurity, that the government can't protect their property and that if they walk away, they may lose everything?
I think it's a part of that. I think it's also just, you know, the human drive to restart life and get their lives back on track. They want to stay close to the homes. They want to start rebuilding, and they just need help to enable that effort. We, as an organization, the IRC has responded for the last 80 years to the world's worst conflict and natural disasters. We have experience in the region responding to the tsunami in 2004 and earthquakes in Indonesia in 2006. We saw a similar thing where people just didn't want to lose their homes, leave their homes. So we have to travel to them, give them tools, give them money, and work with them to rebuild.
Bob Kitchen, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Bob Kitchen is International Rescue Committee's Director of Emergencies. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. So speaking of the U.S. efforts on relief in the Philippines, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has ordered the U.S. Pacific Command into action. Pentagon Press Secretary George Little says more than 250 U.S. service members are now on the ground, and the USS George Washington is now making its way to the islands. Here's Pentagon Press Secretary George Little.
Embarked on the George Washington is Carrier Air Wing 5, with more than 80 aircraft, including 11 helicopters. The George Washington can produce more than 400,000 gallons of fresh water per day.
400,000 gallons of fresh water per day, but is it enough? Dr. Ron Ratcliffe is a retired Navy captain with experience with disaster relief in the Philippines. He's now Associate Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Dr. Ratcliffe, welcome to the program.
Hello, good to be aboard.
So let's talk specifically about what infrastructure might be in place, pre-positioned, given the U.S. military relationship with the Philippines.
There is infrastructure there. It's not like we're starting from scratch. I've seen the photos of Tacloban Airport. It appears to be a place that we could certainly get helicopters in. I've seen C-130s in there. But it's a bigger question, and I'm certain that that's what the task force commander and the rest of the relief effort is looking for, those places where we can find a loghead, where we can start to move in the amount of supplies, the water that you were just talking about, the facilities that will need to be put in place to be able to push out into the affected communities. But we've learned from our own experiences here in the United States, Katrina, the disaster around Sandy Hook. Even though the most developed countries have good infrastructure, it may not be enough, at least at the outset, to push the sort of things that are needed desperately for those folks to just pick up the rudiments of life.
Well, but Ron Ratcliffe, you are not involved directly in the relief effort right now, but you have long experience with the military relationship, Subic Bay, Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, at one time supplied an enormous sort of infrastructure boost to the Philippines. You know, describe what that was like and what may have eroded in the sense that, you know, those bases aren't what they once were.
Well, you're absolutely correct, is that those bases in their day were some of the most impressive military facilities in the world. I first visited there on a destroyer in 1973. On an older destroyer, we really depended greatly on the ship repair facility at Subic, which was an amazing facility that employed somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000 Filipinos. The repair facility, the dock facilities, the airport that were there at QB Point in the Subic Bay area were amazing facilities. And I'm certain that they've atrophied since the days of Mount Pinatubo when I was last there with my own command, a guided missile frigate. We were expecting to go in for a brief visit to do some repair facility work. And what we ended up doing was evacuating Americans from both Subic and Clark Air Force Base. And the facilities there greatly damaged, and that precipitated a lot of the withdrawal of the United States from the Philippines. The Filipinos have attempted to restore those facilities, and by all indications, they still have the infrastructure, although it's degraded, that would need to be upgraded.
We're talking with Dr. Ron Ratcliffe, who's a retired Navy captain. He's now Associate Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. He was referring to the 1991 disaster, the Pinatubo eruption, that precipitated some of the damage to the military infrastructure in the Philippines. Just how vulnerable is the Philippines to disasters? So we've got the typhoon now. There was an earthquake just barely a month ago, and you're describing a volcanic eruption that did so much damage.
Well, one of the problems with the Philippines is it sits on the volcanic ridge, And as a result of that, it has been subjected and will probably in the future be subjected to volcanic activity. And then just the nature of typhoons that blow in out of the Pacific, she's always in the path of those, not unlike our own southeast United States. What really should be focused on there is the resilience of the Filipino people. They are some of the most amazing people in the world, industrious, talented, and resilient. They have suffered many disasters, and they continue to find their way back. And I think that's why they look to the United States, because of a relationship, a long-standing and special relationship, that we take very seriously their plight, and hence the quick response by the U.S. Navy and other military forces to help them restore their lives and to continue the process of rebuilding after natural disaster.
So you're feeling a sense of responsibility based on that special relationship between the U.S. and the Philippines?
I think it's one that's been longstanding. We've had a relationship with the Philippines since the Spanish-American War. We fought a long insurrection there, but we also, after World War II, quickly set them on the path to independence. We established a mutual defense treaty with them to ensure that their state security would be secured at a time in the Cold War where that was an open question. And it's one where we have a huge Filipino population in the United States, and as evidenced by all the efforts here to send aid that direction. So, yeah, in a longstanding special relationship, that's in the sense that I say that.
Our thanks to Dr. Ron Ratcliffe, retired Navy captain with experience of disaster relief in the Philippines, associate professor now of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Let's give you some sense now of the details emerging in Tacloban, the city hardest hit by the typhoon. City officials continuing to urge residents to leave to ease the burden on supplying food and water to the population unable to move right now. The first attempt there at a mass burial has failed. A police convoy of trucks carrying more than 200 bodies on its way to a mass funeral faced gunfire and had to turn back. Tacloban's mayor, Alfred Romualdez, has described an extreme shortage of vehicles and heavy equipment and personnel for extracting bodies and dealing with the deteriorating salvage situation and growing disease threat. Some of the sense of crisis still in the very early days in the Philippines. Coming up, maps and calendars, an atlas of low-lying areas in the world besides the Philippines, and closer to home, how cash flow determines the calendar for check-to-check American families. How do the days on the calendar reflect the rhythms of your life? Is your life measured out in paychecks, welfare checks, rent bills, tuition bills, coffee spoons?
Casey from Texas. The days just before payday are the toughest for my family. That's when food and gas are low. But the car needs gas to get to work, and without work, there's no paycheck, so gas always wins. And my husband and I will skip meals so the kiddos don't miss out.
You're not alone, Casey. One of you in Stillwater, Oklahoma, writes, a week before payday, I cut back to one or two meals a day, so we'll have enough to eat. What governs your monthly budget? Give us a check-to-check calendar. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation, or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
Peaceful sound, right? The waves hitting the beach. Somewhere in the world right now, the tide is coming in. Somewhere, it's going out. Estimates of the storm surge, not so peaceful, from Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines reached as high as 23 feet, and in some places, seawater churned up by the storm far exceeded that. The typhoon's eerie fingerprint of a waterline left everywhere the storm wreaked its havoc will tell the tale eventually. Right now, the official estimates of this storm's actual surge are closer to 13 feet. So a question. Can we visualize a 13 or 23-foot or even the not-so-outlandish 50-foot storm surge map of the world? Forget the high ground. Can we head for the low ground and see how much of the world's population, indeed how much of civilization, is below this imaginary now but eventually all-too-real waterline from the anticipated severe storms of this young century? James K. Mitchell is professor of geography at Rutgers University. Professor Mitchell, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Can we envision a map of the world that really just basically takes the population in the low-lying areas? What are the numbers? And, I mean, the places are obvious, but it's the numbers that I think bear repeating.
It's about 40% of the world's population is within about 60 miles of a coastline. That's true also in the United States. About 40% of our coastline is in coastal counties. So that population is growing. The estimates for the United States are that by 2020, there should be another 10 million people living in those coastal counties.
And geographers such as yourself and emergency preparedness officials are increasingly making maps like this, that we really need to know who's going to be below water in the kinds of storms that we anticipate over the next several decades.
Yes, there's a wide variety of activities going on to map the flood risks, the storm surge flood risks. What there probably is a deficiency in are the maps that show what the vulnerabilities of those areas are, not only the places, but the people. Those sorts of maps are kind of lagging behind the maps of the physical flood risk.
And when you say the physical flood risk, you know, you're talking about the climate change idea, the idea that the sea level will rise. It's this unpredictability of storm surges that really underscores a completely different kind of vulnerability, right?
Yeah, the unpredictability is one part of the question, but there are many other factors that enter into deciding whether or not a given storm will become a disaster. It has a lot to do with the numbers of people and investments that are exposed in those places that are at risk, a lot to do with how well protected they are and what capacity they have for bouncing back after they experience the event. So all of those things have to be taken into account in order for humans to make a judgment about how severe these problems will be.
We're talking with Professor James K. Mitchell, who's professor of geography at Rutgers University. Do you mind if I quiz you a little bit on some of the physics and just pure geography of some of this?
You can try.
All right. Is there a way of saying what continent is more vulnerable here in terms of just, access to the ocean, the fact that it has the longest coastline, that sort of thing?
In general, Asia, particularly East Asia and South Asia, would be areas where not only you have a lot of low-lying coastline, particularly on large river deltas, and that's mostly agricultural populations, but you also have many large cities like Mumbai in India or Manila in the Philippines. And you have a wide range of fairly affluent cities like Tokyo on Tokyo Bay. So Asia in general, but particularly East and South Asia, would be areas that would be very vulnerable. But that's not to say that both the eastern and western coasts of the North Atlantic Ocean aren't vulnerable too. It's a different kind of vulnerability there.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, we get a sense that an island nation like or an archipelago like the Philippines would obviously be vulnerable to storms, but there are a certain category of physics that can churn up water and amplify a storm in coves and closed systems like the Mediterranean or the Caribbean, yes?
Yes, indeed. And if you look at where Tacloban on Leyte in the Philippines is located, there's an eerie similarity in its general sort of topographic layout and its relationship to the ocean to the lower New York Bay area on the east coast of the United States. And the storm appears to have approached from a very similar direction that Hurricane Sandy approached the eastern coast of the United States. And the waters got bottled up in a rather similar kind of bay, the same sort of effect that took place in New York Harbor in Raritan Bay in New Jersey.
That's chilling. Are places like the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean protected because they're relatively close? Or maybe the Arabian Sea is probably a better example than the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, what really the issue is in places like the Arabian Sea is there aren't the large tropical cyclones that produce the winds that push those storm surges ahead of them. They don't affect that area of the Middle East. So you have to have a major storm system, and you're only going to get those where hurricanes travel, or typhoons as they would be in the Pacific, or some equivalent extratropical storm like the very deep depression that swept across the North Atlantic in 1953 into the North Sea.
Well, when you want to see who is most vulnerable in the low-lying areas, what is your source? What map do you look at? And encourage our listeners to maybe take a look.
I would go immediately to a map of population, a global population map of the world. It's the best shortcut to determining at least who's exposed to the problem. It won't necessarily tell you how well protected those people are, but it'll tell you at least the population numbers that are exposed. So I'd combine a storm surge map with a population map of the world as a first cut.
All right. James K. Mitchell is a professor of geography at Rutgers University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So forecasting your monthly budget can sometimes feel as unpredictable as a storm. Terry sure thinks so.
My name is Terry Windhorst from Needham, Massachusetts, and I am a widow with three kids, and we rely on Social Security for a third of our income, and it gets paid on the second Wednesday of the month, which means that sometimes we can get paid on the 9th, sometimes we can get paid on the 14th. That can wreak absolute havoc with our budget.
Stormy budgetary weather there from Needham, Massachusetts. In Salem, Oregon, I get paid bi-monthly. My wife gets paid every Friday. The majority of our bills are due within the first 15 days of the month. This makes the first half of the month a little tighter than the last half. The first half is for bills and groceries. The last half is where we get our savings and play money. No date night before the 15th in my house. I love that detail. I love those stories. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. One more thought on geography. Turning our attention to the Caribbean, one place on our map of vulnerable coastline communities, a big storm surge could have a considerable effect. Our friends down at WLRN in South Florida have been looking at just such a scenario. Tim Padgett is America's editor from member station WLRN in Miami. They've just completed a report on sea level change projections in the Caribbean. Tim joins us. Tim, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
So what are the disturbing numbers, and who's most vulnerable based on your community of listeners there at WLRN?
Well, most vulnerable would be the western islands of the Caribbean, particularly the Bahamas, and that's because the eastern islands of the Caribbean basin were often formed volcanically, which gives them a little more breathing room, more breathing space as sea level rise continues throughout the century. The western islands, like the Bahamas, though, are just downright flat. And that makes them particularly vulnerable, particularly when you think that a lot of islands in the Bahamas chains are only about 2 feet above sea level, and that's well below a lot of the projections that that scientists are making for sea level rise in this century.
Tim Padgett, how much of this is based on climatery information, and how much of it is based on really population movement towards the coast, so that there are actually more people in harm's way?
All right. I mean, you have to consider that because the Bahamas don't have a lot of industrial base, the Caribbean islands, island chains like the Bahamas depend greatly on tourism, and that puts 80% of your population, for example, in a lot of places in the Bahamas, on the coast. So more than a three-fourths of most populations in the Caribbean dwell on the coast, and that creates that exacerbates the projections of not just vulnerability but damage as we go on in the century.
Does the tourist industry support the kind of investment that would end up protecting those businesses, those vulnerable populations?
It's going to have to, and we're going to have to see a combination. According to the Caribbean community, we're going to have to see a combination of the tourism industry ponying up more to create more adaptation and mitigation measures, seawalls, levees, and that sort of thing. But we're also going to have to see the industrialized world pony up as well. And that's because, according to CARIGOM studies, the Caribbean islands produce less than 1% of the greenhouse gases that many scientists say produces the global warming. warming that produces sea level rise. And as a result, Caribbean community nations really don't think it's that unreasonable then for the industrialized world to help it pay the mitigation tab that it's staring at, which could be, you know, into the high tens of billions of dollars.
Is there a debate going on regionally about precisely that sort of trade-off of responsibilities, the industrialized world helping to invest to protect some of these vulnerable communities?
Oh, we've seen it for years now. Countries like Guyana, for example, that is facing a lot of sea level rise forecast problems. They've been looking at ways to create carbon exchanges, et cetera. It's always been a big topic in the Caribbean basin. How can we make it more attractive for the industrialized world to invest in things like sea level rise adaptation measures?
And where can people go to see, how low you can go there in the Caribbean in terms of these vulnerabilities?
Well, organizations like the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center based in Belize, they're looking at islands like the Harbor Island, for example, in the Bahamas, which is particularly low. And they're projecting that in 50 years, if a lot of serious measures aren't taken, you could be looking at most of the deluxe hotel resorts, for example, on islands like that, being lost.
Underwater.
Because the beach resource there will be so eroded that you won't have that kind of resort complex.
Tourism on the way out in places like the Bahamas. Tim Padgett, America's editor at WLRN in South Florida. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
So your conversation about food stamps this week pushed us to think hard about the calendar, economically speaking, about the days of the month when checks and benefits come in and the days when things just end up being pretty tight. Roughly three-quarters of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck or benefit check to benefit check with little or no emergency savings. That's according to a survey released this year by Bankrate.com. So we were asking about the days of the month that are better or worse for your budget, the rhythm to the checks that come in and out of your account. How does it work for you? Shane in Attleboro, Massachusetts, tells us his schedule affects his meal schedule.
I get paid every other Friday, so sometimes during the second week, I only eat one meal a day. I'm 6'1", 145 pounds, so that makes things a little difficult.
Takeaway listener Katrina Paschal works in the healthcare administration in Rockford, Illinois. Katrina reached out to us with some thoughts earlier this week on her food stamp budget and ended up giving us a sense of her check-to-check calendar. Katrina, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
So how challenging is it for you first week of the month, middle weeks of the month? Are you more of an end of the month kind of person?
I'd say that the end of the month is the one thing that I look forward to. I do have a little bit left over as long as I follow my budget. But, the first 3 weeks is just as far as my existence goes.
And Katrina, who are you responsible for? Who has to basically abide by this rhythm?
Well, right now I'm a 26-year-old female. I don't have any dependents. So I ended up moving in with my grandparents earlier this year. So I'm more like had become some of their dependent. But I help my grandparents out with food, and, they've been so great with allowing me to stay there. So, but other than that, I mean, I only get paid about a little over $1,000 in a month's time.
And to Katrina, your grandparents are on their own sort of check-to-check schedule if they're on the Social Security or relying on retirement, right?
That's correct. They are relying on Social Security benefits, Medicaid, and definitely some compensation from when they had worked from before.
And what's their month like? Are they top of the monthers or bottom of the monthers?
You know, they're actually they're pretty happy to be alive, and they do eat once, maybe twice a day. They don't go out, and they don't talk about it. They've stopped talking about it quite a long time ago, because it's hard.
Okay. And how do you divide up your month to be able to make it through?
Well, I have like I have what's called an A-B budget, and of course the A is the A-check, and I just try to find out what is going to be taken out of, which check, and I just abide by it down to a few dollars at the end of each check. Like right now, I only have, $26 until Friday.
And check A and check B, just refer to your two main sources of income. I mean, you don't have to tell me where they come from, but that's literally how you categorize things.
That's right. I mean, I try to plan for savings, but usually it goes to something that I should have done last year, like get new tires or an oil change or something.
So you need new tires.
I did get new tires last year, but it had been like 8 years since I had gotten them. So
your grandparents are not going to like that, Katrina.
No, I know. And they helped me a lot. You know, I ended up getting, I had some more work done on my car that I couldn't afford, and they helped me out with that this past summer. So hopefully, you know, you just pray to God that things just don't happen.
Well, 3/4 of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Katrina, thanks so much for reaching out.
No, thank you so much for listening to us.
Katrina Pascal works in healthcare administration in Rockford, Illinois. And other voices living paycheck to paycheck.
This is Better Akbar from South Miami. The middle of the month is the best because I get paid every 2 weeks and I don't have to worry about, you know, the barrage of bills that come in at the beginning of the next month. Most wiggle room is around, you know, the 13th to the 17th for a young professional like myself.
Where's your wiggle room? We'd love to hear your story of how you manage a check-to-check existence. Whatever fixed income you're on, you can be, you know, in retirement or on food stamps. We'd love to hear the story. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
If it feels like an impossible task, perhaps that is the surest sign it is an important one. We shift our focus now to the civil war in Syria with two very different perspectives on what can be done there. In a moment, how the wisdom of designers might help a people to govern themselves even amidst a civil war. But first, can real tangible diplomacy in Syria take the conflict beyond the latest crisis over chemical weapons? Wolfgang Petrich was Europe's chief negotiator at the Kosovo peace talks. He has long experience in the Balkans. Petrich says, based on his experiences, there are opportunities for diplomacy in Syria right now, but time may be running out to apply lessons from the conflict in former Yugoslavia.
There are certain structural similarities when it comes to the root causes, for example, who usually are social, economic crisis, unfair representation, and so on. And this is true for Yugoslavia and, of course, also for Syria. But then again, the escalation, and this is my second point, is something which one has to watch very carefully. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, the war went on for 3.5 years, more than 100,000 people killed, 50% of the population displaced and refugees. Therefore, the solution that was found eventually in Dayton is not really ideal. It stopped the war, but it is no blueprint to build a state. On the other hand, you have Kosovo, which was about 4 years later, already warned, so to speak, by the Bosnian experience. The international community, Europeans, the Americans, decided to act early on. And this early engagement actually brought about a better start for state building.
Well, a great insight there, if there are disturbing lessons from the Balkans based on what's going on in Syria right now. I'm wondering if the reality in Yugoslavia, in that it was breaking apart into countries and entities that predated the Cold War, if that was an assistance in the sense that there was a map somewhere that was going to represent peace. That's not the case in Syria, even though there might be an argument for partitioning various places in the country to deal with the sectarian tensions. That's really not an option in Syria, right?
Well, right now it is not an option, obviously. Therefore, one would have to figure out what kind of, models short of partition should be considered. Of course, I mean, the situation is such that you have now a minority rule that needs to change. But on the other hand, you have to give the minorities there, particularly the ruling minorities, the Alawis, a real confidence and tell them that we will take care of your safety, which is, of course, not so easy. And then there are several models, of course, federalization, decentralization, autonomy, territorial autonomy, and in the end, of course, also in a way, what has happened in Bosnia-Herzegovina, so to speak, there are two entities highly autonomous under the umbrella of the state of Bosnia-Herzegovina.
You know, one thing that really strikes me here is that the map made during the Cold War has been a much more elastic map in terms of borders changing and countries being restored to some form of autonomy post-Cold War, much more elastic than the map created after World War I, which is really what you're looking at in the Middle East. You just mentioned the situation in Syria, Libya, the same. There seems to be no return in the Middle East to a pre-World War I map. I'm wondering if that's a complication.
Well, of course, the map drawn by the former colonial power, so to speak, is something which is highly sensitive because they are so arbitrary. Like, think of the Kurds. The Kurds are now in six different countries in the region, and there are vested interests, let's say, in Ankara as well as in Iraq, not to go the way of partition because it would have such consequences considered by many not positive ones. Of course, therefore, I believe we need to really have a very good look into what are the options short of partition. That's extremely important. But there you need to find a fair solution. You need to consider who really suffered and who was in a better situation and how to rebalance, so to speak, and come up with an equitable solution. A second point, which is so important, of course, in the region, is we had and still have the European Union. So the European Union, of course, was able to bring the demise of Yugoslavia in many ways to offer them, so to speak, a third way to join the European Union. This is not the case in the Middle East. There, the Arab League obviously is still too weak, but I think another point is really to strengthen regional cooperation, to strengthen regional frameworks that would definitely help to find a solution. Because you cannot see and view and resolve Syria in isolation. So therefore, what you need to do is find an interim agreement. But before doing so, I think you have to take care of the humanitarian catastrophe there. This is absolutely off the radar screen right now, and this is the biggest immediate problem there. And then, not second, but in parallel, you should really aim for a ceasefire.
A final comment on the world today, in the sense that you've been an experienced diplomat through this whole post-Cold War period. Do you think the world in general is getting more numbed by humanitarian catastrophes? And at the same time, are diplomats facing much more complicated questions of diplomacy, or are they just not as skilled as they were a generation ago?
Well, they are. I'm sure they are very skilled, but they are ill prepared for this new situation that you just referred to. I believe that we have to invest much more, not so much financially. This is not such a expensive business compared to the military, but greater sophistication, better education, learn how to mediate, how to engage at the level, at the sub-level of government, civil society. You need to activate. Incremental steps are important. Interim solutions are important. And again, I repeat myself, the humanitarian side is scandalous. That needs to be the priority number one.
Wolfgang Petritsch, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wolfgang Petritsch is the former Austrian ambassador to the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. He was also the EU's special envoy and chief negotiator at the Kosovo peace talks.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
from diplomacy to design thinking as an approach to intervention in Syria. Are there networks of people and communities of interest that could create the capacity for peace and governance closer to where people live and far from where diplomats negotiate? Alexa Courtney is the executive vice president of Caris Associates, a strategy and design firm that focuses on conflict zones, including Syria. Listen now to the mind of a designer with the heart and dedication of a great humanitarian.
A challenge like Syria, where you have many overlapping dynamics and it's hard to sort out what's actually driving the conflict, what are the sets of grievances, you have many, many actors, all of whom have their own agenda, it's hard to know where to start. The U.S. government couldn't go in and interview and try to really understand from a human perspective what was happening on the ground, bottom up. That was really an opportunity for us to say, we think we can bridge a really important gap. So we worked with Syrians on the ground and developed multiple different networks and then worked with different government clients who had some really pressing issues and questions, I might even say blind spots, and connected the two.
From the perspective of someone who's observed the United Nations and a lot of these conflicts, I think most people have the impression that, well, all you do is put a blue helmet on, say that you're the United Nations, you walk in and then everybody talks to you.
Yeah. For many years, I worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development, and I did exactly that. So I would go in with a team of other Westerners trying to understand what the drivers of conflict were in places like Afghanistan, Nepal, Bangladesh. And, you know, we had pretty sophisticated research protocols, and we would ask questions, and we thought we were getting good answers. It turns out you really have a profound observer bias when you're doing that. And the more sensitive the question in Syria, for example, who's funding you to do what, takes a long time to build up that rapport. And in very conflict-affected environments, there's very low trust. So you just can't parachute in from the outside and ask those very sensitive questions.
One of the issues that came up in the John Kerry hearings after the chemical weapons controversy that came up in the fall was how many of the opposition are jihadists whose only interest really is establishing a base and getting a bunch of weapons and eventually turning their guns against Western sources. There were lots of percentages thrown around. There were senses of most of them are jihadists. Very few of them are local. How do you resolve something like that?
Despite some of the numbers thrown around, you know, we've been able to say that there's roughly between 3,000 to 10,000 members of a group like ISIS or al-Nusra, both of whom are al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria. Small relative to some of the numbers discussed in that Kerry briefing. What's really difficult is to sort out the ambitions and the objectives of a variety of opposition groups, some of whom are armed and clearly have transnational terrorism objectives like ISIS. Others are really just focused on kind of protecting their turf and trying to win the allegiance of their population. So in the city of Aleppo, we're running a different project where we're working with networks on the ground that on a weekly basis are updating in real time on a geospatial platform called Caris Geo how checkpoints are moving around the city and who manages that checkpoint. And the reason we care about checkpoints is because that is a proxy indicator for territorial control. And so then you can look neighborhood by neighborhood in Aleppo and see which ones are under regime control this week. Have they shifted? If they're under opposition control, who's managing those checkpoints? You get a very clear sense of the actors and their patterns of influence in a town.
Now, who's uploading that information to the geomap? Is it local spies? Is it just citizens?
Citizens whom we've trained. We pulled them out to Gaziantep in Turkey and trained them on the platform and the research protocols. Then they went back. They're all Aleppo residents, and they kind of reflect a broad demographic. Some are citizen journalists, students, doctors. It's really a range. And so on a weekly basis, they're uploading directly there. And then we're doing the data analysis back here.
And so when policymakers come to you and say, who's controlling this neighborhood of Aleppo, you have a precise and correct answer.
That's updated weekly.
That's hugely valuable, it seems.
It's incredible. And it really just shows the power of the ability to plug into real-time decision-making by building trust on the ground. Another just quick example, we were asked by the government last fall, what do we do about the bread and fuel shortage in, I think this was also in Aleppo, last November, December timeframe. And you didn't really see any reporting about this shortage yet in the New York Times, but our government clients were asking us about it. And within 4 hours, our staff were Skyping FSA commanders, Free Syrian Army commanders, who controlled many of the supply routes into and out of a particular neighborhood in Aleppo, and were able to actually understand what was driving the bread and the fuel crisis, which was not at all a shortage. It was very intentional campaign of influence by the regime. They had bought up all the surpluses. They were denying it into a lot of the rebel-controlled areas, and then people were lining up long lines, and that was creating a lot of tension and nervousness, and that was very intentional. The trick here, and again, just to underscore the point, is to take key patterns in the environment that we're able to validate on the ground with confidence and plug that into U.S. government policy decisions and planning processes, right? And I think that's really important to be able to be that bridge, because otherwise there's a proliferation of assumptions and major blind spots. And I think bringing it back to design for a moment, really seeking first to understand from the community's perspective all of the very complicated dynamics has to be your starting point. Or you make policy blindly, you push through programs that aren't going to have meet the objectives you want, or worse, have really negative impacts. So I think this is a really, really important role we're playing.
Based on what you see, do you think the U.S. should be more involved in the outcome in Syria, in controlling the outcome in Syria?
That's a tough one for me as a former U.S. official. Yes, I would have liked to have seen us do something much bolder early on, you know, years ago. I think now it is really difficult to sort out what to do, and we don't really have the domestic political capital to support something that I think would be bold. It's an incredible shame to see the chronic suffering and the devastation, and it's pretty clear to me that it could undo the region.
Does the Foreign Service and military planners need more designers to create credible policies as this century moves forward?
Fundamentally, because I don't think policymaking is about deciding between two options. As Roger Martin said, you know, people who invoke the power of analytical thinking will choose between two options. People who have grown up in the world of design are very expert at creating options for a future state. So designing for a revolution or mitigating a revolution is hugely important. It's a fundamentally different toolkit.
A design challenge.
Indeed.
Alexa Courtney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alexa Courtney is Executive Vice President of Caris Associates. It's a strategy and design firm that focuses on conflict zones. Love to know what you think about those conversations. Does it empower you to feel as though action can be taken in a place like Syria? We've also been hearing from you about your paycheck to paycheck rhythms. My paycheck drops into our checking account every weekend. My husband drops in every other weekend. The weekends both our checks land, we call fat weekends. That's from one of you in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. What governs your household economy? Give us your story at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.